Welcome to the Urban Lab with Sam Chandon, the podcast on cities and the built environment, featuring leaders in industry, research, and policymaking.
Welcome to the Urban Lab. I'm your host, Sam Chandon. Along with my colleague, Richard Florida, I'm teaching a special course at NYU this summer focused on how the world's major urban centers have responded to the pandemic, the challenges they're facing in managing the public health and economic crises, and how they can chart a path forward to renewed and more inclusive growth. Today's episode of the Urban Lab includes excerpts from our first class, Global Cities in a Post-Pandemic World. We open with some observations on the protests taking place in cities and towns across the country. We then turn to the fundamental question of whether cities will remain essential engines of innovation and growth, even if social distancing and remote work become permanent features of our way of life. Richard Florida is Distinguished Fellow at the Schack Institute's Urban Lab and University Professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, where he's also Distinguished Scholar in Residence at the School of Cities. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Rise of the Creative Class, as well as The Great Reset and The New Urban Crisis. He is founder and editor-at-large at City Lab and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. Professor Florida, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dean Chandon. It's a delight to be with you.
So today's conversation is about why urban centers are important and why they'll remain important. But I'd like to take a step back before we address those questions. Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen Americans rise in protest on a scale that I don't think we've witnessed in a generation. While the death of George Floyd is the proximate cause, there's a larger context of the country's history of institutionalized racism. But also over the last couple of months, the ways in which we've seen an abrupt decline in employment, there's been a disproportionate impact on communities of color. When we look at the impact of the virus, we have markedly higher rates of mortality in communities of color. How much of the expression of frustration and anger that we're seeing in our major urban centers reflects the immediate experience of this inequality across all of these dimensions?
There is one major reason I'm an urbanist. And I already mentioned I was born in 1957, so that would have made me 10 years old when Newark exploded into civil unrest and what they called at the time riots. And my dad was actually, I wanted to be a guitar player. That's another whole nother story. My dad was taking me to my guitar lesson in Newark, New Jersey on a nice warm summer July morning. And, you know, we saw tanks in the streets. We heard gunfire and the National Guardsmen told us to turn around. So my whole steeping as an urbanist was as a young boy. I mean, I didn't know this at the time, thinking about why was my city in flames? Why were African-American people and Black people engaging in civil unrest? Well, and as we learned, of course, that was an issue of police brutality. Most civil unrest in the United States, not all of it. And there's, by the way, there's a fantastic, several people, one former NYU faculty member who's now at Princeton, but remains close tie to NYU, Patrick Sharkey, and another current NYU faculty member, Tom Sergo, who's in the Marin Institute, are kind of experts on this. So, but, you know, this bout of civil unrest is different than the other one. In 1968, cities were on decline, right? And affluent people and industry were moving. There was white flight. Cities were really decaying and were being abandoned. Now what's, I think, interesting is that, and the unrest tended to take place in largely minority neighborhoods that were underinvested in or disinvested in. Now, in fact, cities are on the tremendous upswing, right? We've seen this massive gentrification. We've seen this massive urban revival, especially in a place like New York or downtown Los Angeles. And the unrest has been concentrated amongst the symbols of that. You know, it's been Chanel stores and luxury brand stores and the Supreme. I mean, it's very interesting in that the targets have been symbols, if you will, of commercial gentrification. I think you're, of course, right. This was simmering. It was obviously a result of a heinous act by the police of police brutality. It reflects a long history of structural and institutional racism. Of course, the lockdown, the social distancing, and the virus all helped to fuel this. And I think, as you said, Sam, this has fallen so disproportionately hard on communities of color In the study they did of the Mission District in San Francisco, where these great epidemiologists and health professionals went out and sampled thousands of people in this very diverse area of San Francisco that has a high yuppie and professional population, a high minority population, Hispanic, Black, also a high Asian population and Caucasian, a lot of technology workers and homelessness and poverty. They found that almost every case was concentrated among a frontline worker, people who could work remote, or they could hardly find any. And moreover, more than 90%, I think as high as 95% of cases were amongst Latino, Hispanic, and African-American people. And then the rate of unemployment, the reduction in labor force participation, it just fueled the fires of this. And I think, given the fact that, I don't want to get a political editorial, but the fact that we haven't had leadership in Washington, and the president has poured gasoline on this, created the conditions of a tremendous powder keg. And I think it's less the damage. It's interesting for me to think about this. The health problem is probably the least significant part of the challenge to urban America. It's the economic fallout and civic fallout that probably, and the fiscal fallout, as we'll talk about, the budgetary fallout, the ultimate impact of this on local budgets, that is going to be bigger for urban America. So this is, of all my life, this is probably since the 1960s, the most challenging time in our history.
If we can spend one more moment on this, what is your thinking on the reasons behind the disproportionate impact on communities of color when we're looking at the way in which the pandemic itself has taken such a terrible toll? Is it higher density housing? Is it dependence on public transportation infrastructure? Is it underlying conditions? The data shows such a stark difference. There have to be real contributors here.
It's like 4 to 5x. It's just unthinkable, unimaginable. I have a friend who's a very conservative urbanist who he and I have, we were mortal enemies who sometimes these things happen, you become friends. His name is Joel Kotkin, and Joel and I were talking about this. We come from very different perspectives. And he said, the disease here is poverty. And, when you hear someone who's much more conservative echoing your own thought that the real endemic disease is poverty, and all of the health conditions and vulnerabilities that poverty brings. It brings, it brings less access to healthcare. It brings more pre-existing conditions because people don't have the ability to eat better or exercise as much. It brings with it exposure, as you said, just in terms of living conditions, exposure at work, exposure in not necessarily dense, it could be dense, but overcrowded conditions. So we know that a large part of transmission is household exposure at home, where you can't social and physically distance. You don't have spare rooms as professional workers do. But I think it really shows the fact that the United States is a society where the middle has kind of disappeared. You and I've talked about this a lot. The middle class has shrunk. And we have, a smaller group of concentrated advantage, much of which has fueled gentrification and the revival of our cities. And then much larger spans of concentrated advantage. And by the way, I would just want to add one thing. It's not necessarily concentrated disadvantage just in cities. Outlying suburbs close to cities that border cities also have had high rates of the virus. One last thing, which I think is interesting. I've been tracking events in Newark pretty closely. It's my hometown. And we're working with the city of Newark and the Newark Alliance, the basic CEO-based organization there, to help think about a recovery strategy. And I was very proud that Newark has not experienced the level of civil unrest that New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles, there's been very much civic unrest, but organized protest without any violence. And one reason was for that was that the police force in the city and the community took a new way of policing, community policing, much more seriously. And even though that city is terribly distressed, right? It's as distressed as any city in America. They have been able to go through this in a way that has caused less violence and violent outbreaks. So I just think that's very interesting where policing and community cohesion has evolved. We see more protest and less civil disturbance. So
let's come back to today's other big question. There has been so much discussion and debate in the last couple of months about the future of the city, whether cities like New York and Chicago are on the cusp of deep, long-lasting fiscal crises, about whether urban centers will remain important given the profusion of technologies that have made so many of us location independent. Of course, it's important to keep in mind that the digital divide has also never been more apparent. The technology haves and have-nots are experiencing the pandemic in very different ways. Forget about consumerism. Those of us who are in the lucky position of being able to work and create economic value remotely. A lot to cover. In helping us to think about whether cities will remain important, start by telling us why they've been important up to now.
Look, cities have always been important. They've always been kind of the cradles of civilization. And going back through human history, what you will find is our densest settlements at the time were always the places, you know, even when we were kind of primitive, very rudimentary societies, ancient societies. As we developed more density where people could connect, talk to one another, begin to form languages, do rudimentary cave paintings, create simple tools, that those things tended to occur in the relatively densest human settlements. So all through time, innovation, technical advance, economic progress tended to come from cities. And for the basic reason is that we're just more productive when we combine forces. You know, when human beings combine forces, when we live close to one another, when we talk to one another, when we share ideas, we tend to become more inventive. We're more than the sum of our parts. And cities are the container. Cities, when I say this, communities, neighborhoods, not necessarily big giant cities. Now they're big giant cities like New York and London and Tokyo and Paris. What I think happened is that we had this thing called the Industrial Revolution. And during the Industrial Revolution, we had in cities, and those cities were cities like, you know, Venice and Milan and Turin and then Manchester and London, and then ultimately coming to the States in places like, you know, New York and Newark, Paterson, the New England, Boston area, Lowell, and then spreading out to Detroit and Pittsburgh and St. Louis and all the Rust Belt, Buffalo, the Rust Belt cities. We started to develop these new technologies, the machine technologies, and large firms, large corporations, General Motors. You know, Kennedy famously said, what's good for the United States, General Motors is good for the United States. And I think we kind of changed our perspective, and economists and sociologists started to talk about how industrialization was the motor force, and often said urbanization was the secondary force. As we industrialized, we urbanized. But what's fascinating, and at that point, I think we believed that industries were important and that they could be go anywhere. Industries, especially as developed advanced industries, automotive plants could go to the Sun Belt. They could leave Detroit. They could go to China. They could go to parts of Asia. And with computing and the internet, then people said, well, you can go in. And Thomas Friedman wrote a famous book, the New York Times columnist, called The World is Flat. That was his thesis. In an era of advanced technology and communications, the internet, distance and place didn't matter anymore. You could do things from anywhere. What happened, of course, is as we globalized and as we developed technology, just the opposite occurred, which is so interesting. We reverted that cities became more important. And what you saw over the past really 20 years is industries like finance, media and entertainment, all of these knowledge-based industries become more and more concentrated in a relatively small set of what people call superstar cities. Cities like New York and Los Angeles and London and Tokyo. But what's super fascinating, unbelievably fascinating here, is that technology-based industries, which everyone believed were suburban, you know, the Silicon Valley being the paragon, of a suburban set of office complexes that one analyst called the Nerdistan. The Nerdistan was the model where engineers would drive a Porsche or a hot rod, you know, from their suburban house into a suburban office complex. And Silicon Valley probably accounted in its heyday for 90% of all high-tech startup companies, the Intels, the Apples, and of course Seattle had some like Microsoft, but they were all suburban. Beginning in about the year 2000, that shifts. And certainly accelerating after 2010, these high-tech industries move from the suburbs to cities. So it's no longer that Silicon Valley is about the fourth or fifth largest center for high-tech industry in the United States today. The number one location is downtown San Francisco. So it's still in the Bay Area, but it moved to the highly concentrated neighborhoods abutting downtown San Francisco. New York, which when I was a kid and when I was in graduate school had no high-tech venture capital startups, now is number two. And that's really the area around NYU, the area around Tribeca in Soho, up to lower Midtown, a little bit over into Brooklyn. And so we've seen, and then outside the United States, London, Berlin, Shanghai, Beijing. So it's interesting that we've seen this movement of industries. And the reason people say this is the case is because talented people, especially younger people, and we'll get back to this, but not just younger people, began to prefer a more urban lifestyle. They didn't want to commute as much. They didn't want to live out in a suburban area. They wanted more vibrancy. They wanted to be close to universities. More. I think the rise of this resurgence of urban universities like NYU, and NYU's surge up the rankings, but not just NYU, USC, the University of Chicago, Brown in Providence, we go on and on. They became hot places that great faculty and great inventors and great students wanted to go to. So for all these reasons, cities came back. And I would say this to put a bow on it. If cities have always helped to organize innovation in the past, they've now become the fundamental platforms. So really our economy now is no longer organized just by corporations. Our economy now sits on if the corporations were the platform of the industrial economy, really cities and clusters, if you will, clusters of firms and talent and universities, these ecosystems are the platforms of our newer knowledge globalized economy. So yeah, I think cities have become more important. And that's why in the long run, I don't think the COVID crisis will undercut them. It may cause a pause and it may cause a delay and it may cause a dip. But I think the force of urbanization is a stronger force than the force of infectious disease.
Technology comes along in a way that allows us to collaborate remotely. And yet, instead of that acting as a substitute for cities, it somehow is a complement. And we see the emergence of what you described as superstar cities. Why is it then that with all of these technologies that would presumably allow us to innovate, collaborate, at least to some degree, without physical co-location, that we still see the value of the city, you know, strengthening? Because when we have density and scale, there are a set of products and services that we can provide that we simply cannot provide in the absence of density.
100%. So I think, you know, for some people, and we'll get to this for sure, especially those with families, we have seen for a while, and in many ways, the crisis doesn't disrupt things. It just accelerates changes underway. And so we have seen people with families prefer suburban locations and do remote work. So some of that has occurred. But the countervailing trends are a couple. One is, you mentioned young people. Young people, I don't want to say they're suburban averse. They're not, but they're young. They graduate from universities. Their friends tend to cluster in cities like New York or Boston or Chicago or LA or San Francisco. That's where they know people. They realize that even you or I probably don't need, or alumna who are mid-career, we've developed a personal network. We can take that. I interviewed Peter Jackson, the great filmmaker, once on why he moved to Wellington, New Zealand. He said, but I had to go to LA first because I had to build a personal network. Now that network isn't as important because I can call people on the phone or Zoom with them or Skype. So for young people, I think the ability to build a personal network in FaceTime, right? Real face-to-face time and to build those, many people in technology always say the same thing. Every job I've gotten or in finance has come from a personal connection. It's not from sending a resume in. The second thing that young people need is to make friends and to find not only a labor market, but a mating market. You know, your chances of finding a desirable mate in a city are just much greater. There's much more eligible pool of people than if you're in a suburb where mainly people are family. So they're not eligible by definition.
My first professorship was in Hanover, New Hampshire at Dartmouth College. I have firsthand experience of what you're describing, but please go on.
I faced the same thing in nearly 20 years as a professor at Carnegie Mellon, because Pittsburgh had lost its youth cohort as a result of the steel crisis. So, and I think the industries, that what cities have done, many industries, retail, medical, and education can spread all over the country, and that's happened. But certain industries, finance, media, entertainment, technology, and then the arts and cultural and creative industries, which are often inputs, key inputs as though the industries, those have become extraordinarily concentrated in cities and urban centers. I think because those industries really require co-location and co-location to one another, to talent and to end users and customers, which you mentioned. So those big high profit, high wage industries have become incredibly co-located. Now, you know, that means if you have a family, you could live in a suburb of New York, but or you could live in a suburb of San Francisco, but you needed to be near those industries. Now, I do think one result of the crisis, the COVID crisis, will be, a lasting result will be an uptick in remote work. So, and I think that's gonna have a differential effect on different cohorts, which we'll talk about, but I don't think it'll bring a bit at the end of cities. In fact, I would argue that cities from an economic point of view may become more important as travel restrictions, if travel is restricted. You know, if it's harder to get between, let me give an example. Venture capitalists need to be in close contact with the companies they invest in. I was talking to a venture capitalist today who said, if those companies are not in his region now, he's probably going to have to charter a private plane to get to them. That is not economical or efficient. So, because there's no flights, it's not that he wants to charter, it's just no other way to get there in a remote. So that will mean that venture capitalists will suggest to their investments, if you want money, you have to come within driving distance to me. And I think the spread of remote work is different than the concentrate. See what I'm saying? You can spread workers, but concentrate industries. And from this point of view, I think that this, what I call the spikiness of the urban fabric, may get even more exaggerated. It's hard to predict. I don't have a crystal ball, but that's one thing we need to keep an eye on.
Are the dynamics you're describing a constant in, you know, advanced economies around the world? You know, when we go to, you know, India, when we go to different parts of Europe, South America, the Middle East, are we seeing a similar set of drivers in favor of urbanization?
Yes, and maybe the United States is on the weak end of that. You know, I did an analysis recently, published it at CityLab. I think New York is about, the metropolitan area is about 10% of US GDP. Toronto is about 20% of Canadian GDP. London's about a third of UK GDP, maybe 36%. And Seoul's half of Korean GDP. So in fact, you mentioned Austin. The United States is quite unique. Maybe Germany follows this pattern to another extent, China. And Jane Jacobs, the great urbanist, you know, who's influenced us all, said this, who also moved to Toronto from New York, said, you know, the difference between the U.S. and Canada is the U.S. has hundreds of small and medium-sized cities. And her view, I'm just quoting her, Canada had two or three. Right, Toronto, Vancouver, and maybe she put Montreal in that, your home city. You know, she was making a joke. But the fact of the matter is the U.S. has a much more disaggregated city system. And I want to say two things. One, I think that what's happened is not only have industries been globalized, the city system has been globalized. So if you're a talented person, you could come to live in New York or Los Angeles or London or Toronto, or not every city, but there's a lot of mobility for talent. And when we look at high tech, which is the industry that is the most concentrated, that industry has distributed itself not only in the United States to places like Austin and Denver, but London, Berlin, Toronto, Stockholm, Amsterdam, Beijing, Shanghai. The U.S. now is about 45% of the concentration of high tech industry, and about 55% is outside the United States. Some of the top cities are Shanghai and Beijing and London in the top 10. The other thing is about why does a place like Austin rise? Well, I think it's very hard. The big cities like New York and London and Tokyo and Shanghai stay pretty much constant. I mean, they do rise and decline. Athens was once the biggest, and Rome was once the biggest, and Amsterdam, but they're very constant. What tends to happen is the smaller places, the Pittsburghs, the Detroits, the Clevelands, they begin to decline as industries decline. And then new places like Austin, which was so smart and strategic to build up around the University of Texas and invest in semiconductor and computing technology. Denver, which is now on the upswing because it's become an affordable alternative to the Bay Area. Nashville is one that I really focus on. That's become really one of the world leading centers of entertainment and music, vying with New York and London and LA because it really focused, like laser focused on building its tech. And then you know, where Pittsburgh, where I lived for nearly 20 years, which isn't a complete comeback, but by building up around Carnegie Mellon and technology, has been able to build a robotics industry and now a self-driving car industry. So you can do it, but it takes strategic and intentional action. And one thing I'll say about the U.S. is having strong research universities distributed has been a big plus. But the other thing, which people don't really like to talk about, if you look at almost every success case in the U.S. outside of the big superstar cities, there's been a very wealthy philanthropy. You know, Pittsburgh had the Mellon and Hines and Carnegie Foundations. Detroit had many, many large foundations. Even when I do work in Tulsa, the George F. Kaiser Family Foundation is spending large sums of money. You know, almost every city when I go do my work, those that have had this legacy of large foundations, which could help organize resources around a revitalization, as well as a great research university, have had a much better chance than those that don't have a research university and don't have those large foundations. Many factors, but that's some of them.
One more question on this. In these cities where, as an economic agent, I am simply more valuable, we are going to invariably see higher housing costs. Is it a strategic error on the part of economic development folks, city officials, that we are not investing in the kind of housing we need to maintain socioeconomic and importantly, occupational diversity within the city?
Yeah, and for folks listening in, what Dean Chandon talked about, an agglomeration is an economy of scale to a place. It's a cluster of related things that just makes massive improvements in productivity. And in fact, some economists like Robert Lucas, who won a Nobel Prize, and also Paul Romer, a Nobel Prize winner from NYU, argue that that's the fundamental force of economic development. It's really the clustering of human capital, human beings, in cities that magnifies productivity and generates innovation. So, yeah, what that does is cause a different kind of inequality. We usually talk about socioeconomic inequality. What you and I talk about and what folks listening in should be really concerned with is spatial or geographic inequality, where you get that at two levels. One, you get New York and London, Tokyo, Seoul, Mumbai, we could go down the list, really operating on a different planet and more connected with one another than they are with the other cities in their own country. And, you know, in my book, The New Urban Crisis, I actually looked at the numbers. I think for the cost of an apartment in Soho, a two-bedroom, you could buy like 20 houses in Pittsburgh, 30 houses in Detroit, 50 houses in Memphis. It was like mind-boggling. So, yes. Then for the highly skilled workers, well, you see this with Facebook. What did Facebook say with its remote worker? You can go remote, but you're going to take a salary adjustment. So for companies to attract talented people, they basically have to pay in salary the additional cost of housing. So what happens is that there's a large cluster of talented people in technology and finance that immediately bids up the cost of housing, which makes housing less affordable for everybody else, causing displacement of working people, middle-class people, artistic creatives, and actually undermining the very vibrancy of a city. So yeah, I think your specific question was about, well, how do we create more housing? I think there's been a big argument that we should be more NIMBY. NIMBYs are not in my backyard. We don't want to build housing. We want to keep Greenwich Village the way it was. We want to keep Soho the way it was. We don't want any tall towers. We don't want to ruin great neighborhoods. The NIMBYs say yes in my backyard. We have to build more housing. I think, though, the crisis takes a little pressure off. And you know me because you know I said this in 2001 after 9/11, and I said it in 2008 after the financial crisis, wrote a big essay in the Atlantic Monthly that said the crisis would give cities a pause, a reset. We might have a couple of years where housing becomes more affordable, and I think that's going to happen with the trauma in the retail sector, the retail apocalypse, the trauma in the commercial office market, the fact that some families will leave cities, older people will leave cities. We might have YIMBY by proxy. We may have enough surplus stuff, housing and convertible assets, that housing prices can go down. But I'll tell you this, and folks, I'll tell every one of you this. Every time this happened in the past, 2001 and 2008, people said cities would decline, they wouldn't come back, people would move to the suburbs. I said no, cities would come back, and I completely blew it because I said there would be this elongated pause. I fully underpredicted. You know, this is my greatest sin. I'm being very honest. I fully underpredicted how fast, how ferociously cities would come back in the wake of 9/11 and in the wake of 2008.
That was Richard Florida, distinguished fellow at the Schack Institute and university professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. I'm your host, Sam Chandon. Thanks for listening to The Urban Lab.
Thanks for listening to The Urban Lab. For more information about the program and our host, please visit samchandon.com/urbanlab.